It's your road and yours alone. Others may walk it with you, but no one can walk it for you. Jalal Rumi. Welcome. This is the Leaders Commute podcast produced by Business Radio X. We're coming to you from the Subaru of Gwinnett studio inside the Gas South Convention Center in Duluth, Georgia. I'm your host, Jess Villegas, and I'm the principal at Acuity Business Consulting. We support leadership teams by providing execution expertise in the areas of strategic design, financial management, operational excellence, and leadership development. The Leaders Commute podcast centers around the power of recalling past experiences that persistently return to us over the course of our lives and prompt us to acknowledge their influence on how we think about business and leadership today. My inaugural podcast, The Russian Junkman, considered the dynamic of what it is we choose to collect and retain. Today's podcast, Exposing Ghosts, focuses on what it is we choose to deliver. The choice of a commute theme for this podcast series is very intentional. At its core, the Leader's Commute is an awareness strategy that you may be able to apply to your circumstances. Since my son Justin's a prominent character in today's story, I invited him as my guest today. However, he's clear these are my recollections and therefore he has no editorial control over the content. But hey, we're all free speech guys around here, so I guess I might stomach an opinion or two. Okay, let's begin. Thanks to everyone out there for listening, and perhaps you're even doing it on your actual commute.
Let's go! Let's go! Come on, Aiden, we're going in! Here we go, Aiden, come on! Good, good!
I love the sound of a stampede of runners working to gain position and advantage, advancing in a 50-yard-wide swarm, funneling feverishly down to a 15-foot-wide path. I'm not a runner or even a jogger. You might say I'm a stomper, the imperfect expression of mass, awkwardly plodding step by step to escape the pull of the earth in increments of 15 miles a week. This is a habit I formed over several decades, and though I'm not fast, I have a strong sense of what's involved in expending this type of energy. This is why I was really excited when my son Justin informed me that he was joining the freshman cross-country team. I never saw this coming because he would rarely join me on a casual run and often said that he hated running. For those not familiar with cross-country, the process for encouraging improvement on a team is to measure each individual against their teammates and then constantly gauge progress as they make their way up the ranks. During his early high school years, Justin was a casual competitor, typically residing in the low to middle of the pack range on a team of approximately 90 runners. The very first race of Justin's career was an interesting experience. I stood with the coach at the one-mile split, our stopwatches in hand, waiting for my first look at him as a competitor. Shading my eyes and looking out over the grassy course, I anxiously scanned past the lead pack of runners to the long column of runners behind them to get a visual lock on him. At first, I could not spot him. But then, I almost missed him because at the very last half second, I realized that he was in the lead pack of runners that were in that moment blowing right past us. "Coach," I yelled, "is that where he's supposed to be?" Knowing full well that it was not. In a slow, beautiful, southern drawl, he calmly stated, "I believe he came through here a little too fast." Not surprisingly, Justin was significantly slower at the 2-mile split, and by the end of the race, he seemed to be barely crawling over the finish line. By then, over half the field of runners had caught up and passed him as if he were a ghost. Afterwards, I asked him what he was thinking going out so fast. He gave me a big grin. He said, "Dad, there's just something about having a whole bunch of guys chasing you." Before a race towards the end of his sophomore year, Justin told me that he expected to have a breakout race. He explained that the combination of a dry and relatively flat course, the crisp October weather, and a really good week at practice all pointed to strong prospects for a personal best time. He also noticed results from earlier races of the day were proving his theory of faster speeds. I told him I too was excited and then quizzed him about his race strategy. Would he start out slowly and then kick hard to the finish line? Would he go out really strong, burn himself up, and outlast others to the end? Or what I like to call the freshman strategy? I just couldn't help myself with that dig. "My plan is to keep up with John," he said. John was a close friend that happened to be ranked just ahead of him on the team. He figured that John, already the faster runner, would absolutely benefit from the great running conditions, and that keeping up with him would mean a great race for him. With a little encouragement, I question why he would stake his effort against someone who was just a little better than him. I also ask why he wouldn't just try and keep up with Keith, the fastest runner on the team. Come on, Dad, advice like that is much easier to give than to do. I smiled and I wished him luck as he went off to the starting line. At the 1 mile split, Justin was running substantially faster than he had at any point in his career. I glanced around to see where John was positioned, but I never spotted him as everything around Justin melded into a blur. By the 2 mile split, it was apparent that Justin would indeed realize a personal best time. I hurried to get a good viewing location near the finish line, stumbling several times on the uneven ground through intermittent gazes at my stopwatch, my excitement building for my son. It was easier than I thought it would be to get a good viewing spot at the finish line. As the fastest runners in the field passed through the finish line, their well-wishers vacated the area to give congratulations to them in the cool-down area. Most of the runners were in various states of decline, working to catch their breath and moving into post-race analysis, which involved coaches and family members. I wondered how the construction of these elite runners was different than the rest of the runners in the field. What did they do differently? What did they understand that others did not? My drift into various theories was loudly punctured by the sound of Justin's voice. "Daddy," shouted, "I did it. I got my personal best by a lot." He flashed his numbered placeholder like a lottery ticket, feeling good about the result, but not being exactly sure about the official time. "Fantastic," Justin, I yelled, and then I asked how John performed. "Dad, he ran so fast. There was a lot of bumping and pushing, and when I finally got to a comfortable pace, I looked up and he was gone. I sped up trying to catch up, but I never did. Let's find him." Justin and John leapt into a high-five choreography and blurts of personal best, both knowing they had a great cause for celebration. They swapped stories about the intricacies of the course and they hypothesized on the placement of their fellow runners. When they finally got around to comparing where they were respectively placed in the race, they looked at each other in disbelief. Justin had inadvertently passed John and finished several places ahead of him. Justin thought he was chasing John, but realized he was just chasing a ghost. None of it seemed important to them. They were ecstatic, and their genuine happiness for each other's success stifled my urge for an "I told you so" moment. All the episodes in the Leaders Commute podcast relate the concept of an evolving context. That is, the knowledge, competencies, and skill sets we build at various junctures of our careers can give new context and meaning to a particular type of past experience. Let me give you an example. For many years, I would relay the story of Justin's inadvertently passing his friend John and running faster from the "father is smarter than the son" paradigm. I may have peppered in some deep wisdom about self-limiting beliefs and not basing success on what others do, blah, 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 but it was really just about touting my undeniable fatherly wisdom. This was not a very mature approach, but it was an easy story to tell for an exceptionally long period of time. You might say this story had a lot of legs. As I developed more skills in self-reflection, and objectivity, the retelling of the story changed from the "father is smarter" paradigm to maybe I am in my own version of middle of the pack, and maybe I am imposing self-limitations and don't realize it. This was a more evolved lessons learned because it encouraged me to do some things differently in my efforts to improve. Today, I tell the story from quite a different place, one that has nothing to do with me or Justin, but with how to think about a much larger spectrum of variables within any system that is working to produce a certain kind of result. In this version of a past event, more context and more awareness gave me more constructive ways to frame the experience. Whatever Justin's aspirations were at any point in his career, he was operating as a system to produce a certain kind of result. I recall hearing a story about Jesse Owens, the extraordinary American track and field athlete who won 4 gold medals at the 1936 Olympic Games. The most prolific of the events was the 100-meter dash, which he won in 10.3 seconds. The compelling part of the story was that, Had Mr. Owens run in the same 2009 World Championship race in which Usain Bolt established the world record for the race at 9.58 seconds, he would have finished dead last. But the narrator continues to explain that if he had run on the same high-tech surfaces as Mr. Bolt, he would have finished within a single stride of him. But in 1936, races were run on cinders, which is the ash from burnt wood. These soft surfaces stole energy from legs that could otherwise go faster. Whenever I recall this information, I also remember Justin mentioning the importance of a dry and relatively flat course and how it contributed to his breakout race. If he were an engineer, he may as well have said minimal moisture in the topography and the low incidences of ascending and descending angles will reduce friction levels on the exertion of energy on mass over a prescribed time and distance. Not the most prosaic description of a race, but definitely something to think about. When working with leadership teams, I often pose the question, what is it that you're trying to do with this business? I get a range of predictable answers associated with activities to get products or services into their customers' hands, from the point of view of what most impacts their respective roles. At the end of this exercise, I state, although I have a limited exposure to your business, would it be okay if I took a crack at the answer? To be honest, I should have really asked the question, what is the system trying to do in this business? Whether you're selling signs, shoelaces, garden hose, architectural drawings, house cleaning services, legal counsel, or anything else, you are a delivery system in which you, number one, input stuff into the system such as time, capital, ideas, labor, material, partnerships, innovation, brain power, mission, vision, etc. Number two, convert stuff within the system into something else by virtue of applying direct or indirect energy to it. And number three, extract stuff from the system to move it into someone else's system. Stated more simply, you put something in, you do something to it, you move it out. Assuming this is the intent of the business, it would follow you would want to replicate this process in the most effective and efficient way possible with the least amount of friction. In other words, you'd want optimum velocity. This is the manner by which the cost of doing something is rationalized by the immediate and the residual return on that effort. So my question to the leadership team is, what is occurring in the business that is causing velocity to either increase or decrease, and what are the best things that can be done about it? Friction in a system typically surfaces as a constraint. It refers to a condition, boundary, or parameter that limits or regulates possibilities and outcomes. Some constraints are easier to spot than others, especially if they have a physical manifestation. For a business, that might look like an undersized warehouse, understaffed or poorly trained workforces, poorly maintained equipment, and limited capital. For a variety of reasons, other constraints are more difficult to see or may be in a blind spot. These might include a lack of information, the capabilities of your suppliers, the warehouse capacity of your customers, or a highly ambiguous state of future cash flows. If you look even deeper, you might find that the focus of the leadership or the competencies of the middle management or the cultural aptitude of the organization could in some way be slowing the velocity in the system. When I think about runners in a delivery system, and I come back to my son's experiences, I consider that a freshman struggling to make it to the finish line after blasting off from the starting line could be a tale of youthful exuberance. But it can also be about a lack of experience or training or self-discipline. These constraints are easy to spot and can be mitigated. A sophomore working to catch up to an individual that is behind him could be the tale of youthful miscalculation. But it can also be about a lack of confidence and an attachment to a safe solution that shifts responsibility for one's success to someone else. These constraints are more difficult to spot and address. One could experience an existential crisis when considering the number of variables that exist for impacting the velocity of the system. But typically, in the 80-20 rule fashion, substantial results can be realized by addressing a few of the highest leverage areas. The key is to facilitate leadership teams that are attuned to finding that leverage in order to optimize possibilities and outcomes. My son's running experiences were a catalyst for me to think about where the ghosts are in the organizations I've managed. I have found a couple of strategies helpful in this effort. Number one, just ask the question I posed earlier. What is occurring in the business that is causing velocity to either increase or decrease, and what are the best things that can be done about it? The question posed in this way depersonalizes the issue and orients the entire team towards looking at the system in its entirety and applying that context to the respective areas of responsibility. This is more galvanizing and powerful than jumping headlong into untested assumptions or solutions, or by searching for names and faces on which to assign blame. Number two, stress test the things that are going well. In other words, test your success. Untested success is a particularly tenuous ghost. If Justin's strategy of keeping up with John had been achieved, he would have still realized his personal best time, and we would have shared the same jubilation. But we would not know if he might have done better with a different strategy. Justin eventually found a strategy for testing his success. His constraint-breaking breakout race eventually led him towards finishing third in the 2001 Georgia High School State Cross Country Championship. If I didn't say it then, Justin, I'll do it so now. Congratulations.
Owens is ahead. Stenberg and Borschmeyer fighting. Odendorf challenges Rykoff. Metcalf comes up, but Owens wins in 10.3. Second, Metcalf America. Third, Odendorf Holland.
Since I invited Justin to be on the show, I'd like to kind of hear what he has to say. And Justin, how are you?
I'm good. I appreciate the 25-year late congratulations on my accomplishments.
What
a sign of really appreciating me.
All right. What about the year? I wasn't sure if it was 2001 or 2000, but I knew it was sometime in there.
It was 2001. That's poor research. You could have gone and checked that for sure.
I could have done that, but I couldn't Google it because I don't know who cares about a race in 2001.
Yeah, all right. I don't think there's many of them.
All right. So, well, listen, thanks for joining me. You know, I know that a good bit of this is fairly accurate. I think one of the points I try and make is that, you know, these are sort of my recollections. And one of the things that surprised me when I talked to you or others about things that really stuck with me is that sometimes individuals themselves don't even recall the situation. And they're certainly not going to recall it the way I did. But I'm just wondering, just generally, whether you felt like the information I gave was, you know, relatively accurate or how you received it.
There was some artistic license in there, I think. Mostly, I wouldn't have said some of those things as corny as I think you had me say them. But generally, that sounds right. What's interesting to me, just hearing it, and you know, I've heard the story several times between when that happened and now, but listening to it now is interesting because without getting too far into it, and you mentioned it a little bit, running had become a really important kind of driving point in my life that, you know, like anything, has led to kind of where I am today. And so I have 5 or 6 or 7 stories about my running and kind of how that shaped me and how that's led to where I am today that, you know, in my mind and in what's important to me, I rank more important than that one. So it's interesting, though, to hear the story for you. It's not, you know, it's not for me to necessarily care about. It's interesting to hear how it affected the way that you think about things and the way that you think about leadership and teams, you know, since that point.
Yeah, I do recall I really was excited when you started running. And I think I don't know if you ever said you hated running, but I know that when I was plodding around the neighborhood, it really wasn't that easy to get you to come to join me. But I don't really think you started running seriously at all until you joined that team. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that's right. Though I don't know that it was really my decision at that point. I feel like there was a heavy hand that might have kind of pushed me in that direction at the time. But no, I think that's true. And you know, I ran competitively through college, so I had another, you know, I think eight years of competitive running after that story. And I will say I never ended up liking it very much. So that's definitely accurate. That never changed from from the first feelings I had about it.
No, there you go. I guess you don't have to be extremely passionate or love something in order to try and get good at it. I tell people, for you, it's running. Maybe you got really good at it and you didn't maybe love it. One thing I got really good at, but never loved it, was accounting. And the only thing I tried to do, accounting is about 5% of my background now, but back in the day, it was the way I was earning my living. And I thought, I got to get better at this so I can show someone else how to do this. So the other thing Justin was going to ask you is just kind of remind me, one of the things that was heavy in my mind is anytime I write the year 2001, you start thinking about, you know, 9/11. You ran, I believe, the championships that year were in November of 2001. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it was the end of the year. So that was about 6 weeks after 9/11.
Yeah, I kind of seem to recall, didn't you even have a plan, or wasn't there a plan for the team to go to New York and for you guys to do some running? I knew you guys were a pretty good team.
Yeah, we were supposed to go to New York. We had something planned before that meet, and then that got canceled. There was bigger things, more important things at that time that I didn't get to New York to run a race. But I think when I look back on it, and you say 2021, I recognize how long ago that was. It's funny to think about all of the things that have kind of happened since that point, where that was definitely, you know, part of the catalyst for it to kind of where I am today. It's interesting to feel old, I guess, based off of that timeline.
So if you feel old, I guess I don't have to finish that sentence.
You know, listening through, and obviously I was familiar with the story, but listening to some of the connections you made with it and some of the conversation that you had around inputs, I had a couple of questions about that. Just, you know, one of the things that you seemed to kind of mention coming out of that was the idea of how the inputs, I guess, ultimately affect the output and considering the inputs when you're trying to figure out what you're trying to achieve. You know, one of the things that you mentioned about the race, you talked about the fast course. There was a lot of things that were in the weather and those sorts of things. There's a lot of inputs for that one that were out of my control, right? And good and bad, like any situation, there was inputs that were out of my control that can't really be considered kind of when you're planning for things or things like that. So I'm curious about how does that kind of translate when you're talking about it in a business sense to people of there are a lot of inputs you kind of have to react to rather than try to adjust, right?
Yeah, I like that question. And I'm going to say to the audience right now, that was an unprompted thing on my part for you to ask that. But I love that you asked that question, because I hadn't really worked that angle into this write-up. But I'm happy to answer that. And the way to think about that is, when you couldn't do much about the course that day, your ability to take advantage of what was going on with that course is the fact that that just happened to be where the race was, and it just happened to be a dry day. And one of the things I like to say to businesses when they're thinking about ghost, if you just take the most literal definition of ghost, which is something that's just not really apparent, and think about companies that can spend a lot of time really trying to change and react to circumstances that they can't do anything about, that would be the form of a ghost. So for example, if you came to me, and I'm being a little ridiculous, but if you came to me and said, you know, that course is pretty flat, but I'm going to go out there and make it a little flatter, I'd say, well, Justin, maybe that's just not a good use of your time, or maybe you shouldn't do that. And you might say, well, I got a friend, he has a bulldozer, and if we can go just get that one hill burnt down a little bit, then I can run faster over that one. I said, you know, you could do that, but I just feel like the payback on that's not going to be great. So when I talk about chasing ghosts or exposing ghosts, it can be not only trying to find the things that are most complex to find, but it's also not giving importance to something that doesn't deserve that importance. And I have worked with a lot of organizations who spend a lot of time worrying and thinking and agonizing about things that they can't do anything about. But that doesn't mean they can't leverage what the circumstances are. So I'm touching a little bit on stoicism here, but one of my favorite stoic quotes is called, impediments to action advance action. What gets in the way becomes the way. And what that essentially means is, what gets in the way of a cross-country race that's flat is that it's not flatter, but it is what it is. What gets in the way becomes the way. You embrace it, you use it, you work it, and then you leverage it. And so my encouragement to businesses is, find the right thing to talk about. And this is why you want to have a team together, because they will surface typically the right thing. There wouldn't have been 10 runners that said, yeah, I agree with Justin, let's get a bulldozer and go bulldoze that hill. Because 10 people will be stronger than one person whose idea maybe doesn't quite gel. So that's a long answer. The short answer is, there's just some things that aren't worth the effort and not worth the attention. And that's how I would think about that. But now the good news is, you've got all that free brain power to work on things that really do matter.
I was just going to say, I think what's interesting is that all makes sense to me. And I think there's some things that are foundational as well, which is, you know, what you told a little bit of that story from freshman year. And I don't know if that was the timing or not, about me going out fast. I do remember that race and you looking over to my coach and him saying that I believe he went out a little too fast. you know, there's something else that's foundational and that's an input that you don't recognize. And that is, you know, there was 60 kids on that team. I wasn't particularly good at that point. If I was that coach, I'd be thinking, why is this dad standing next to me right now? This isn't the parent that should be getting extra attention based off of how their kid's running, but you were out there doing that too. So there's the issues you can't deal with, but then there's the things that kind of lead in and build in to the opportunities that you're currently in that you can capitalize on too. And what's interesting to me, particularly about that, that's not a story about you being a good dad and supportive when I wasn't a very good runner. I'm curious how some of this insight translates to different industries. And so, you know, specifically, you've probably talked a little bit about this, or maybe not. You know, a lot of the industries that you've been in your career, I know, have kind of been manufacturing focused or about kind of creating that tangible thing. I've spent my career in services, you know, in different ways, but generally some version of selling ideas rather than kind of selling a product. And because of that, you know, a lot of my focus as I've kind of worked through my career has been more focused on kind of doing some of that preparation, doing what I can for those inputs, and then reacting in the quickest, smartest way that I can to kind of put myself in a good position to deliver ideas and thinking that makes sense. But because of that, I've never needed to be particularly diligent or particularly intentional on a day in, day out basis when trying to mold some of those inputs into a final result. And so I'm just wondering, and this isn't necessarily me asking you, but this is something that I was thinking about as you were talking about it. As people are listening to this and they're making some of those connections around input and output, I think there's different ways to deal with those inputs to kind of get that output that you want. There's probably a more clever way of saying that I don't have. But I do think it's different because I've seen you and I kind of have to deal with it really differently just based off of our careers and the things that we do.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent point. And again, a nice opportunity to think a little bit about how systems operate. And so you're right. I've been more recently in the distribution side of things. But I like to think about it this way, is that a lot of times when you're in manufacturing, you're essentially creating buffers and queues where you're putting effort and energy and money into things that you could actually be making wrong. But, you know, what the hell? You make it, you put it out in the warehouse, and 6 months from now, someone might figure out that you got the wrong color. And that's kind of a lot of the business I've been in. So if you didn't have that urgency up front and have the right inputs up front to mitigate or have that high quality control, you might not know that you weren't performing well today for 6 more months in the industry that you're in. And I like this about the industry that you were in and other people who are similar, is that there's an immediacy not only to the circumstances, but to the feedback that you get for the people that you're trying to serve. And so it's almost like I equated to when I used to work with a fast food joint when I was a kid. You knew right away if the food wasn't good, someone was going to tell you. No one was going to tell you that 6 months from now. And so right. I think it's an interesting observation, and I've only really thought about that now, that the way you think about your day-to-day and my day-to-day is different, and we have to expend some energy just kind of reconciling our thought processes before maybe we get down to the meat of an issue, so I kind of appreciate that insight.
But on the other side of it, I spend less of that energy on the upfront. I just, because there isn't a lot of reason to spend that energy for things that are always just going to fundamentally change significantly right. Before there's an end product, even if that product is, you know, some sort of thinking.
Right. Well, listen, Justin, I want to ask you another question, because you said something that made me think, and I wanted to at least make sure I got this asked. You said there were several different situations, 6 or 7 other events or races, you know, that would have come well after me because I didn't get to see you compete all the time. Do you have a kind of a quick particular one where that experience has kind of shaped something you think about today?
The first one, which is not as success oriented, that I realized is, you know, I realized this looking back through my running career. You know, I did it until I was 22, 23. And it's funny, I had just been meeting with several of my friends that I had run with in college. And when you're in that scenario, you start thinking about things you hadn't thought about in a while. And what I started to realize is just the amount of stress and anxiety that was always around me in relation to running. It just was always there. And I don't know what the reason was, but what it makes me think of is, I remember back in my senior year, I had gotten, you know, much better than I had been in some of those earlier stories. I was in one of these big national meets. There was a lot of college coaches there. It was going to be important for me to run well. And in the first half mile or maybe mile of the race, I don't remember exactly where it was, I just had a panic attack. I had to stop. I had to sit on the side of the course and I couldn't run. And it was all of this. It wasn't over preparation, but it was me feeling very overwhelmed with the amount of different inputs, right? Of that I couldn't necessarily control and that I wanted to control. And even if I could control them, I couldn't control them all at once. And so one of the things that's a race that I actually think back on much more often, because it's the one that taught me about almost literally being paralyzed by the things that you can't control. And so I think that's probably why I asked some of those questions earlier on, was trying to understand kind of how that plays in. Because one thing that has taught me as I've looked at, or as I've continued to grow in my businesses, I guess essentially what I was just saying before, which is that idea of getting much more comfortable reacting and getting much more comfortable saying, hey, these are things that can't be handled right now. Now, you know, the risk of that is you can take it. That's almost an excuse to never prepare in any way, right? If you don't do it the right way. So finding that balance is obviously key. From a running standpoint, that's definitely one that I hearken back to much more often. It was a much more painful memory, but you know, for me, a pretty strong lesson.
All right. Well, listen, Justin, I want to do kind of one last thing. I appreciate your time, and it's really, really nice to talk to you today. I have a sense of what you're doing, but just if you don't mind, just kind of maybe tell the audience kind of what it is that you're doing and where it is that you do it.
Normally, not right now, but normally I'm in New Orleans. And I work for an advertising agency down there. I'm director of strategy. So when I said that, you know, a lot of my job is providing thinking, you know, a lot of my job is not only providing thinking, but then convincing people that it's decent thinking. So, you know, real customer based stuff. A lot of what my job is saying, hey, you need to sell this thing to a customer. And my job is to come in and say, hey, here's the 8 things you might not be thinking about because you're kind of tied into your business and what you're trying to accomplish. So that's when I'm saying that I'm selling ideas more. That's kind of what I mean.
All right, Justin. Well, listen, really enjoyed talking to you. I'm going to just say again, I didn't want to do any prep. I figured we'd just start talking and we'd do it the way we do it, you know, when we're having a beer once in a while. So I really appreciate you joining, and don't forget to call your mom.
I won't.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Leaders Commute podcast. If you would like to reach out to me, you can do so at 678-644-9311 or email me at jess@acuitybusiness.consulting. Perhaps I can assist you to find your ghost. You can catch a new episode every month here on Business Radio X, or you can find us on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you enjoy your favorite podcast. I'm Jess Villegas, and you've been listening to the Leaders Commute podcast on Business Radio X.